tackling issues on post-conflict reconstruction. I mean, we talked about this morning already on various occasions. Iraq was mentioned, NATO's mission in Iraq, Afghanistan was mentioned, also our operation in Kosovo was mentioned, and I thought it would make good sense to have a much more closer look at NATO's post-conflict reconstruction operations, and hence I'm particularly pleased, I mean, to have, together with our colleagues from WISE, been able, I mean, to talk five very senior and highly professional panel members into accepting that opportunity to talk about this issue. Margaret Prince, I mean, from the Office of the High Representative in Sarajevo in Bosnia-Herzegovina will be chairing that panel, and obviously she will be also introducing our distinguished panelists. So without further ado, I would like to give Margaret the floor, and please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of this event for allowing me to, for the invitation, and it's with great pleasure that I will try to assist the discussion on the post-conflict reconstruction. Let me first introduce the panel members. On my far right is Mrs. Chantal de Jonge-Oudraat, a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations, Johns Hopkins University, and also the vice president of WISE, who is the main organizer of this event. Then Mr. William Dirge on my far left, a senior associate at the Henry L. Stimson Center. Then Ms. Claire Short on my left, member of the UK Parliament, a former Minister for International Development Affairs. And then on my right, Ms. Barbara Stapleton, who is policy director of the agency coordinating body for Afghan relief. So I do think we have the knowledge and the practical experience to make it a worthwhile discussion. My name is Marguerite Prince, as mentioned. I work with the Office of the High Representative now in Sarajevo. I've been on the Western Balkans for a long time. During the war, I worked with the UNHCR and then more recently with the OHR. Today, it has been mentioned here already, today it's 10 years ago exactly that in Bosnia-Herzegovina the genocide of 8,000 men and boys was set in motion after the Serb forces took control over the UN-safe area of Srebrenica. This brings me to one of the main elements I would think any post conflict reconstruction effort must have, which is an early establishment or a re-establishment of the rule of law. To make a general statement on post-conflict reconstruction efforts, we all have to look very much at the local context of the operation, but this is one of the things that all operations need to have in common. As I said, as we speak, a large gathering now in Srebrenica is commemorating this momentous and very painful anniversary. Actually, the funeral of hundreds of its victims is now underway. Bosnia has another anniversary coming up this year. The Dayton Peace Accords were signed and initialed in Dayton, USA, and in Paris, France, 10 years ago. The war in BiH killed an estimated 200,000 people, and it forced 2 million people from their homes. The Dayton Peace Accords, it stopped the war, it ended the war, it did not really stop or solve the conflict. One could argue that the root causes of the conflict in BiH still largely persist. The events, you may not have followed it in detail, but events leading towards the commemoration of today made that all the more clear, that the people in the country have not really yet started to acknowledge what happened in the country. For a lasting peace, people do need to acknowledge their past, and only the truth can lead to this acknowledgement. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, one of the main instruments uncovering the truth is the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. This is one of the reasons that actually today's commemoration is all the more painful. The main responsible for the genocide are still walking free. The international determination right after the war Thank you. Yeah, no, that's true. To bring them to justice was insufficient. And that brings me back, then you do have to wonder how stable the peace will be if people who have this on their conscience are still walking around. Let me give the floor first to Chantal, who will give a framework.
Marit, you're making it very difficult for me and very ambitious. I'm not sure if I'm really providing the framework. I do want to offer some remarks. I think this panel deals with what I would argue should be the core task of NATO today. And I would argue, in a way, it already is. Post-conflict reconstruction, what do we mean with that? Sometimes it's also referred to as peace building, nation building. Sometimes it's called peace operations or stabilization missions. I think it refers, in general, to a process whereby international actors try to help a country move from war to lasting peace and to prevent violent conflict from breaking out again. Now, post-conflict reconstruction, so defined, has been a growing concern since the end of the Cold War and remains of great concern today. Even if it's true that global warfare is in decline since 2001, serious problems remain, and we only have to think about Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, the DRC, Côte d'Ivoire, and others. There's a highly authoritative source here that is the 2005 Peace and Conflict Survey that is established by Ted Gurr and Monty Marshall. They argue that the risk of future genocide and political mass murder remains high in half a dozen countries and a significant possibility in a dozen others. They also identify 31 countries of serious risk to mismanage societal crises and succumbing to civil war or governmental collapse. They also believe that some other 51 countries are slightly less, but still at great risk for governmental collapse. So if you look at these figures, you have sort of half the world who has serious trouble and serious governmental weaknesses. So to say that these internal communal strife, these conflicts, are among one of our top security challenges is, I would argue, not an exaggeration. Particularly if you know that a lot of these internal conflicts often have very serious regional security consequences, and I would argue very often also global security consequences and repercussions. These conflicts also have repercussions on our own security. Now, I think there are three things that we have learned since the end of the Cold War about how to deal with these type of conflicts. First is that international intervention can help stop and prevent violent conflict and is often essential to create the conditions for lasting peace. Secondly, for post-conflict reconstruction to succeed, you need a robust military component to ensure a secure and stable environment. You need boots on the ground who are not afraid to shoot if necessary and not just in self-defense. And thirdly, that post-conflict reconstruction is not a linear process. That is to say that the social and economic dimensions of post-conflict reconstruction go hand in hand with the military dimension of post-conflict reconstructions. I think these are not sequential phases. On the contrary, I would say they go hand in hand. Now, NATO has increasingly taken on these post-conflict reconstruction tasks and has become actually quite good at it. And I would argue that the other top security challenges that we face, preventing and stopping the proliferation of WMD, halting terrorism, are actually more of a stretch for NATO. I have difficulty envisaging NATO mobilizing for a military action to counter or to prevent the proliferation of WMD. Such an operation would be extremely divisive within the alliance. And similarly, I think in the fight against terrorism, our main immediate policy instrument is not military action, but it's cooperation between intelligence services and enforcement officials. In this sense, I think September 11 really was a sort of an exception. And there are no more Afghanistans, as we have actually seen with the attacks in Madrid and in London. The enemy resides within our own societies, and we're not going to attack, you know, London or Madrid. So I would argue that NATO member states should allow NATO to focus on what it does best, and that is post-conflict reconstruction. Now, if post-conflict reconstruction is going to be the future of NATO, if this is going to be the core job of NATO, this has, I think, three main consequences for the organization in terms of both, first, military capabilities, second, institutional structure and decision-making processes, and third, alliances and partnerships with other international organizations. Now, as far as military capabilities are concerned, I think this means continuing the process of transformation, building up lean, rapidly deployable forces. I think NATO members should be pushed, and particularly smaller NATO members should be pushed towards specialization. They should be encouraged to develop these kind of niche capabilities. And I think the NATO military authority should probably want to guide this process and give very specific advice to some of the smaller NATO members for a very specialized type of force planning. I think it also means the further development of the NRF, and I would also argue for the establishment of a new stabilization reconstruction force, as was proposed by our colleagues from the National Defense University in Washington, D.C., Hans Binnendijk and Dick Kugler. Now, as far as institutional structure and decision-making procedures are concerned, you need an institutional framework and a structure to be able to make quick decisions and to allow for troop deployment. Now, there have been and there are several proposals on the table to speed up NATO decision-making procedures and to help how NATO operations are financed, and there are some proposals by the Secretary General. I think in this regard, probably the most important proposals are the proposals that deal with the common funding of operations. Of course, organizational structures matter in the sense that they facilitate action when political will is there to proceed. The problem here is, and we have touched upon this a little bit in the morning, is that there is no real consensus on the future role of NATO. We're maybe nudging closer to a consensus, but amongst those who think that NATO is toast, those who want NATO to stick to its core, I would say maybe Cold War missions, and it's maybe the Helga Haftendorn school, and then the ones who want NATO to do it all, and that is maybe the Gail Mattox school, the organization is being pulled in very different and sometimes contradictory directions. So I think without political commitment by NATO member states to a focused role for the organization, I think NATO will fail and NATO will become toast. Thirdly, what does this mean in terms of alliances and partnerships with other organizations? We talk a lot about the NATO and the EU, but I think actually the more interesting story and the more interesting relation for NATO is not with the EU, but with the UN. I think NATO and the UN are natural allies, and there's a natural division of labor between these two organizations. One provides political legitimacy, the other military effectiveness. There is no inter-institutional security dilemma between these two organizations, unlike the EU-UN relationship, which, as Thomas Vlasek said this morning, is very much a zero-sum type of game, as is the NATO EU relationship. So for these post-conflict reconstruction or stabilization missions, NATO will always need a partner, and I think the UN is actually the best partner for NATO. Whenever we talk about the NATO-UN relationship, people always come with this question, yeah, but what about primacy? Meaning, can NATO intervene somewhere without authorization by the UN Security Council? And my argument, my answer would be, of course NATO can. The question, however, is not whether it can, but whether it will. And there I don't see NATO embarking on a lot of missions without UN Security Council authorization. In that sense, Kosovo was really an exception, as was, for that matter, Afghanistan. I think one of the problems NATO faces is a problem that actually the UN faces as well, is that member states have actually very little animo to intervene in foreign places. Now, I hope Jaap de Hoop Scheffer this morning told us that he is going to the UN in September 2004, and I hope this will indeed lead to a more robust institutional relationship between these two organizations. And to conclude, I would have like four recommendations for the NATO Secretary General and maybe for the NATO member states. I think, one, NATO and the UN should indeed establish full-fledged institutional relationship. They should build up their liaison offices, both in New York and in Brussels, in a serious way. They should establish working groups, I think, on specific issues such as command and control, planning, some information sharing. I mean, it is ridiculous if you think about it that at present you only have, I think, just one NATO officer sitting in New York, and a lot of the UN information center here in Brussels is actually more focused on the EU than on NATO, although I do sense there is quite some interest within the UN to engage with NATO. Secondly, and one of the people this morning talked about that, I think it was Catherine Guégou, who asked the Secretary General about the relationships with the African Union and other African security institutions. And I was a bit disappointed, I must say, with the answer by the Secretary General, because I think this is the way for NATO to go. And I would argue that actually NATO and the UN should take over the coordination of the G8 initiative, the Sea Island G8 initiative, the African Peacekeeping Initiative. They should become the coordinator of peacekeeping training around the world, because at present this effort is being done by all sorts of countries individually and is also often being done at cross-purposes. Thirdly, when the UN and NATO strengthen their institutional ties, I think they have to be very, it's very important that they do this in a very transparent manner, so that they can't be accused of some double standard neo-colonialism or sort of neo-imperialist type of efforts, or for that matter, submissiveness to the US. So openness and transparency of these relationships is, I think, extremely important from a political point of view. And I would urge them also to be very inclusive and not limit this just to NATO members. And last but not least, I would actually want to make a plea for the call by the International Crisis Group, which called for the deployment of NATO's NRF in Darfur as a sort of a bridging operation until the time that the African Union can get its act together. The European Union ESDP is not capable of intervening thus far. And I think it is really shameful, I would say, some of the European members of NATO not realizing that what we should really care about is the plight of the victims and not so much maybe about our institutional prestige. So is that...
Come on. How are we doing? There we go. Great honor to be invited to participate on this panel. I'm going to be following up some of what Chantal has said and focus on some of the same issues from maybe a little bit different perspective. Try not to run over time doing it. Let's look at some of the dimensions of post-conflict reconstruction that Chantal was talking about. There's security, or the end of warfare and the control of societal violence. There's political and governance issues. provision of legitimate and socially accepted rule of law with supporting institutions and principles and respect for human rights, at least as we would envision that goal. There's economics, namely jobs and investment. There's social structures and relations, including the support for civil society and transitional justice after a war. So there's several dimensions to this process. What outside providers are there that provide such services? Well, they range from the global to the singular. There are global organizations such as the UN and its agencies and the international financial institutions, the bank, the International Monetary Fund, regional organizations, primarily the EU and the AU, not of equal capacity, sub-regional organizations such as ECOWAS in West Africa, ASEAN to some extent in Southeast Asia, alliances, principally NATO, states and coalitions, such as the U.S. has cobbled together on several occasions, which tend to be short-term entities, companies, which are private profit-making entities, and NGOs as private nonprofit entities. And all of these are involved in phases of post-conflict reconstruction or stabilization. The key questions, then, for us would be who can do what, on what scale, how good are they at doing it, who is acceptable within host states as a service provider? How can international actors involved in peace support operations and post-conflict reconstruction best be held accountable for their actions, individually or institutionally? It does little good for the West to come into a country denouncing impunity while insisting on impunity for itself. If you deduct the 200,000 or so soldiers that are involved in Iraq in one way or another, and 18,000 fighting forces in Afghanistan, that leaves about 75,000 UN troops and other personnel in the field, and maybe 25, 26,000 NATO peacekeepers, 18,000 or so in Kosovo, about 8 in Afghanistan, which is double what it was a couple years ago, probably a quarter to a third of what it really needs to be to enforce stability in any sense of the word. On questions of military efficacy, one small quibble with what Chantal said in dividing the NATO and the UN, I think with the exception of U.S.-led NATO air campaigns, NATO has been quite leery of using force in the field and very, very cautious in how it has deployed. It can provide troops and stabilize some political military situations where those troops are wanted. As we've seen in Iraq, even the world's greatest superpower has trouble enforcing the peace against determined local opposition that doesn't fight by the rules. NATO members may think of themselves as a global force. That's fine, but where are NATO forces in sub-Saharan Africa? I know there are parts of the NATO leadership would like to see them there. Western states in general contribute only about 5% of the peacekeepers now deployed in Africa, mostly under the UN flag. And I don't see a rush to flood Darfur with NATO troops, even if France were to relent politically. I don't see a NATO ability to field enough forces to pacify such a large region or to supply it over time with an air bridge, because NATO really has no strategic lift without the United States beyond a kind of C-130 level, and that doesn't get you equipment to the field, unless you rely on Russia and the Ukraine, which is very efficient, and that's how the UN does it and how NATO would have to do it, but it's very ironic for someone who remembers the Cold War. And I really don't see much prospect for global membership in NATO, especially to the extent that NATO really runs because it responds to American will as a differentiation from the European Union. And I think the globe's rising powers, especially India and China, would, I think, have zero interest in joining a global NATO, and that leaves out 40% of humanity. NATO would have to create funding mechanisms to support its less wealthy members' deployment needs. The UN already has those. Its decision-making measures are equivalent to those of the UN General Assembly, namely effective immunity without a veto. So why work to create a UN when we already have it? I think instead look at the division of labor that would recognize the narrow political military focus and potentially greater proactive military capability of NATO without denigrating or ignoring the capabilities of other organizations, especially the greater humanitarian development and peacebuilding resources of those organizations. I think Europe also cannot assume that even, and this also goes for my country, the United States, even if it wants to be the provider of the good life to the rest of the world, it's not clear that it would be welcomed by the rest of the world in such a role, or that it could afford to be an active nanny to the majority of humanity. I think it's not at all clear to me, having listened to many assessments of post-conflict reconstruction efforts in Europe, Africa, and Asia, that states and societies can be successfully rebuilt by outside action, or at least primarily by outside action, certainly not within the political decision span of most Western parliaments and their budgets and resources. I really do want this to work. I just don't see a path. To shift a focus a bit from NATO to the UN, the organization that's holding the line in half a dozen situations in sub-Saharan Africa, the UN manages 18 peace operations simultaneously. The NATO manages 2. The UN manages 70,000 troops, 5,000 police, 10,000 international and locally hired civilians with 800 headquarters staff dedicated to the task. NATO manages 26,000 with maybe, 3,000 to 5,000 headquarters staff supporting it. UN does have a cost-sharing mechanism based on ability to pay and a reimbursement mechanism that's pretty much uniform based on the lowest cost members. There's a lot of talk, I think, about UN troop contributors making money among the developing states on doing peacekeeping for the UN, but they do it in very dangerous places, and I think there should be some incentive structure to do that. And frankly, it's not that great a payoff. If you look at it, the average UN cost per troop per year is about $18,000, and that's including wear and tear on equipment as well as individual reimbursement. Best as I can determine, it costs between $125,000 and $150,000 for a developed state to sustain a troop in the field for a year. United States, closer to $200,000. It's more fighting, more maneuvering, even not doing too much. It's about $125,000. So we're talking 10 to 1 difference in cost, or at least budgetary cost. The UN has generated several tiers of standard training modules for peacekeepers. NATO has a long history of and a long series of standardization equipment agreements for equipment and operations. Together, I think these can be combined to create and promote interoperability amongst a wide range of potential peacekeeping providers. On the other hand, the G8 has the Global Peace Operations Initiative, with no implementing secretariat, modest funds, and no real indication that they're going for this kind of standardized training across the board. And that would be unfortunate, since there are standards out there to be used. Well, to kind of summarize, NATO is a capable military organization, but with limited physical reach and no built-in capabilities for the civilian side of post-conflict reconstruction that others need to do. It functions in a world of complementary organizations. These complementarities should be emphasized and collaboration increased, as I think Chantal wisely suggested, between the NATO and the UN. NATO is not only powerful, the UN is not only powerless. Regional organizations outside the EU, outside Europe, either have very low resources or they face very high political hurdles. I'm thinking of East and Southeast Asia, to having substantive regional resources to apply to regional purposes. In reality, in terms of NATO-UN cooperation, we're talking primarily about Central and Southwest Asia, the Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa. I think when we say global reach, that's what we really mean.
Thank you very much. Then I now would like to give the floor to Ms. Clare.
Thank you. My view is that when, remember that moment in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down and Nelson Mandela was released from prison and there was that wave of optimism that spread across the world about how we could use the resources that had gone into mutually assured destruction to build something better. We fantastically underestimated the challenge to our international institutions of the change because for 50 years they've been made around the Cold War. And every structure, every tension in the world, the nature of the UN, all the conflicts in Africa, the function of NATO and so on was all built around the Cold War. We could dream of something better, but when we got down to a real world of growing disorder because the permafrost of the Cold War thawed, we found an incompetence in our international institutions that I think we're still living with, and we're seeing
a problem of very great disorder that's very threatening. I found the discussion that I listened to this morning interesting, but too optimistic for my view. I think we're in a lot of trouble, and we need to sharpen up our minds about what the problems are, what can be done, and how we can reshape our institutions to deal with the problems we've got. And we're the kind of the mindset is lagged, the leadership of the world is lagged, the institutions are stuck in their old roles, and we're doing very badly. So post 89, we had a couple of moments of continuing optimism. Some of the Velvet Revolutions in Eastern Europe and Nelson Mandela, the saint of politics of our age, but being elected, and the transition in South Africa from apartheid to democracy without violence. But then it was failure. Somalia, failure, and it's still a failure, and it's a complete failed state, and its people are dispersed across the world. Rwanda, we'd all signed up after the Holocaust in Europe to always move to prevent genocide. It was threatened, and the UN was warned, and the world knew it was going to happen, and we completely failed to intervene, and nearly a million people were slaughtered under orders in 3 months. And the Balkans, and it's, as we remember Srebrenica today, very belatedly and with weak competence, there was a move on Kosovo, but we let it develop, and my own country had some major responsibilities for preventing the international system being able to reach agreement to act in the Balkans. But the story of the Balkans is a story of failure. I mean, we should remember that, and we came very late, and we still haven't resolved the problems. I think part of the problem is that the mindset still sees war and the military as about conflict between armed forces, whereas the new world disorder is disorder and conflict within countries, with lots of civilians being hurt and displaced, women and children suffering terribly, massive sexual abuses of women as an instrument of war that isn't discussed sufficiently. And I think this is where the whole issue of reconstruction should come centre stage. If we've got a new kind of disorder, and if it's largely within states rather than between them, and within states that are weak states with weak institutions, then reconstruction is absolutely essential, both for people to enjoy peace and to prevent conflict breaking out again, because all the evidence is very clear that the greatest chance of conflict in the world is in countries that have recently emerged from conflict. And as our chair's very important remarks at the beginning about the fragile state of progress in Bosnia and Kosovo. So helping countries reconstruct and build competent modern institutions that can deliver security and development and hope and the chance of a better life to their people is the essence of dealing with the disorder of our current times. But it was not the last election, I think, to be fair to President Bush, not something I reach out to do very often, but the one before, when he famously said, "We don't do nation building," which says something about the mind lag of the world and the problem of not noticing the way in which the world had changed and the need for the world to be able to do nation building in order to have any order and any security and therefore any economic development. So if we look, we've had some success, and it's limited. If you take Sierra Leone, there was a flawed peace deal that involved the people responsible for horrendous violence being given impunity and coming into the government. The UK went in to bring out the Europeans and the UK citizens, and then stayed there because it was suddenly embarrassing to run away when a state was going to collapse. It's talked about as one of Blair's wars. Britain didn't go to war in any way in Sierra Leone. We kind of sat there, and then a failing and collapsing UN peace mission, which was made up of small troops from lots and lots of different countries that started to be held hostage, if you remember, by very weak rebel groups, but to deep embarrassment, I mean, including Indians and so on, you know, from countries with some considerable discipline and so on. And then it was turned around partly by the UK being there, and that was sort of psychological. It gave kind of more sense that the UN was backed up, and the rebels and the UK went in to get one of their own that had got out, and that kind of gave some strength to the UN operation. And the nation-building process started and is still ongoing. But when you're trying to help a country rebuild its institutions from scratch when they've all been destroyed, it is a very, very long-term, very, very, very difficult operation. And Sierra Leone goes on, and it's still fragile, and it's still got enormous corruption problems and weak judges and weak law enforcement and so on and so forth. So that's an example of success, and it's a very small country in a very unstable region of West Africa that's going to be of more and more interest, of course, because there's such rich oil resources in that part of the world, and there's a large number of very, very weak states there. Of course, Liberia's come to peace, but the job of rebuilding isn't there. East Timor is an interesting example, but that's probably worthy of more study as a success story. And Rwanda, funnily enough, despite what it's come from, in terms of rebuilding, is doing remarkably well. But that's partly because you had a rebel army that was strong and powerful and secured order. And it's often the case that you haven't got anyone there that's securing order, and therefore you can't start the economic rebuilding and the getting children to school and all the rest of it. But Kosovo, it was an enormously high-profile operation for the world and some of the biggest countries in the world. But when the military phase is over, which is the easy bit, the interest moves elsewhere. Complex decision-making structures are left there to help Kosovo rebuild, and then a complete failure to tackle the question of the final status of Kosovo, and therefore continuing disorder and an inability to rebuild the economy because people who, the World Bank can't engage if you're not a nation state, and so on and so forth. Very high levels of unemployment, nobody knowing what the final status is. I consider that very weak, and that's a consequence of just weak capacity to make thought-through decisions that would then enable the job of helping the people of Kosovo to rebuild. Afghanistan, similarly, I think is a disastrous error in that, of course, the military phase was going to be very short. But the test was to help the Afghans build a country that gave them a better life. And this is one of the poorest countries in the world, where one in four children die before the age of five. And there was a lot of discussion. I think the bond process, the political process led by the UN, was extremely high quality and very good and built consensus. There was cooperation all across the world to come in and support Afghan rebuilding. But there was an unwillingness to tackle the fact that you had warlords all over the country in different factions and groupings. And if they weren't going to be demobilized and stood down and a national army be rebuilt, then you couldn't get order and you couldn't deal with the drug problem. And there was a failure there, and on it goes. And I'm not at all sure that Afghanistan is a success and is getting any better. And NATO went in, of course, to help stabilize Kabul. And that was a very limited task, and it was successful, but it's not Afghanistan, and the country isn't stable. And then belatedly, we got the reconstruction teams in the big cities, which should have happened much earlier, but it's touch and go. When you go to see Karzai, he's got American security all around him. It's like a symbol of someone who isn't governing his country. And I don't know how I'd feel if I... He's a very nice man, but I don't know how I'd feel if I was an Afghan. And on the question of Iraq, whatever views we all take about the rush to war, the failure to prepare for afterwards is criminally incompetent. And it's another example, I think, of the dislocation because of the quick change from the Cold War to a new world, a failure to have the capacity to analyse what the task is and what needs to be done afterwards. So there was in the US State Department very, very detailed planning for what's to be done after the conflict. There was complex and detailed planning done in the UN, quietly, because it was contentious for member states, but it was done. My own department, we were in touch with my old department in the UK, the State Department, the UN. But then decisions were made to suddenly hand the responsibility to the Pentagon, set up OHA, which was done right at the last minute, a sort of delusional optimism about what would happen in Iraq, and now we are where we are. I mean, I am stunned that the institutions of this world of ours, with all their sophistication, can end up with such incompetence. And I think Iraq is a quagmire of enormously serious consequence for the world and for all of us, as well, of course, of its own people. And I think it's increasingly going to conflate with the situation in the whole of the Middle East, and we could be seeing decades of it, and that will break up our international institutions and our capacity to act together. Similarly, in Africa, the Congo, there was a very sensible peace process put in place, and there is a UN operation, and the French went into the east to prevent a real surge of disaster, but there is not enough attention to driving that peace. And then you've got a country of between 50 and 80 million people in the whole central part of Africa, crucial to the centre of Africa, full of rich minerals that are being grossly misused, that really needs concentrated attention to bring the militias to book, stop the arms supply, start building the institutions of a state. It's going very slowly and badly, in my view, and it's another exemplification of the incapacity of the world to act on post-conflict reconstruction. Similarly, Darfur, we just had the G8 and, you know, lots of concerts for Africa. 2 million hungry, displaced people, with women being raped when they go out to get firewood. And we've got NATO deploying just logistics behind a tiny African Union monitoring mission that hasn't got the powers to enforce peace and to prevent people, you know, the use of violence to displace people. So my own conclusion is we have the capacity in the world and the knowledge, if we look at some of our success stories, to start to bring together the competencies we have to support and help countries to rebuild, but we're not engaging them. We haven't got the world's going backwards in its sort of analytical capacity and its leadership capacity, and you've got institutions casting around for their role rather than pulling together the institutional competence that we have. So I think we're living in an era that could be an era of advance. We could move forward on peace in the Middle East. I think we could even overcome the errors that have been made in Iraq, and I think in Africa and so on, we could have an era of great advance if we'd get behind the peace agreements and help the rebuilding and start to create competent modern states that could get their regional economic integration and start to grow their economies and trade with Europe and so on. But I think we're not doing it, and I think we're in enormous trouble. And I love the dream of NATO and the UN coming together. There's no doubt, of course, the UN, as dreamed of by Roosevelt and Churchill and so on, had a military capacity that's never been put in place. And that wasn't needed during the Cold War years because it wasn't going to deploy, and is really needed now to be able to think through what military operations are needed and so on. But there we are. I'm very pessimistic in the short term. I think some terrible lessons are being learned and are going to have to be learned. And the tragedy of this time is we could be moving forward, but I think we're moving backwards.
Okay, well, thank you very much. As you say, that's a far less optimistic story than we heard today. I'd like to turn the floor now to Ms. Barbara Stapleton for an practical experience.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Margaret. Well, the good news is that the majority of Afghans are still on side. The bad news is that there's an awful lot of ways for NATO to get toasted in Afghanistan. Before moving on to what I've got to say in my paper, I'd like to thank the NATO Public Diplomacy Division and Stephanie Babst in particular for giving me the opportunity to present a range of perspectives from the field at a number of recent NATO conferences, and I hope I find something to say that's still refreshing for both Jamie and Stephanie, who've heard. I think it's my third round with you. My thanks to Weiss. I do hope a chapter can be opened in Afghanistan where there's a lot of very powerful women underneath those burqas, and Akbar would be delighted to facilitate in that. Just the caveat that my paper is written on a personal basis, and though it reflects concerns shared by the 90 Afghan and international NGOs Akbar is extremely proud to represent, it is just that in a personal capacity. And I hope my remarks will be viewed within the framework of the constructive critique they're intended, rather than used to legitimise different NATO member states' agendas. Afghanistan needs more engagement of the right kind, not less. And if lost, Afghanistan will be lost by default. Afghans do not want to be returned to any aspects of their recent past, apart from perhaps the filtered memories of a golden age under the monarchy. I'd like to second the remarks made this morning by NATO's permanent representative of the Republic of Lithuania and Dr. Judith Jaffe regarding key obstacles to NATO's potential success, lack of political will and lack of resources. That's particularly apparent in the example of Afghanistan. And I want to emphasise that money alone will not, however, solve Afghanistan's problems, which, above all, will have to be addressed over time. And that management of Afghan expectations, which has been done appallingly up to now, will entail NATO having to deliver to Afghan concerns on their human security, pushing forward on establishment of the rule of law and order, and especially confronting the issue of corruption, which is skyrocketing. Issues of transitional justice have barely been touched in Afghanistan. My introductory remarks in the first section of my paper are intended to provide a realistic overview of the challenges that NATO faces as it expands its presence in Afghanistan. And in the second half, I attempt to propose some ways forward that could help ensure that NATO preserves the integrity of its mission in the eyes of those Afghans, school teachers, elders, and moderate mullahs who command respect and wield influence within the fabric of Afghan society. Keeping the right Afghans on board will be crucial, particularly as NATO's involvement increases in complexity, with the dual challenge of involvement in peace enforcement as well as peacekeeping operations as stages 3 and 4 of its expansion are reached. The absence of Afghan national security forces capable of securing the state's control over the means of violence in the short term meant that stabilization following the overthrow of the Taliban depended on the international community's ability to react swiftly and effectively to security challenges emerging in the so-called transitional period. Potential responses to the threat that a widening security gap posed to the Bonn process, such as a regional expansion of ISAF peacekeeping forces in 2002, were constrained by a number of factors, however. And at this point, I'd just like to pay public tribute to the sterling efforts of Dr. William Dirch that were such an asset to those of us who were at the rock face of advocacy attempts in 2002 to try to get that expansion of ISAF at that point. Paramount amongst the reasons why that didn't happen was the perceived interest of the US-led coalition forces in its prosecution of the wider war on terror in southern Afghanistan and subsequently in Iraq. But international support for ISAF's expansion was also withheld in European capitals, not only for reasons of insufficient political will, but also due to European dependence on UN capacity when it came to the airlift requirements entailed in any significant force expansion regionally in Afghanistan, as Bill Dirch touched on in his address. And by the summer of 2002, the coalition was reportedly already moving assets out of Afghanistan in preparation for the war in Iraq. Repeated requests to the UN Security Council for ISAF's expansion from President Karzai and the head of the UN mission then, Lakhdar Brahimi, went unheeded. Instead, fears that the state-building process was slipping out of the international community's control drove the development of an expansion in civil-military affairs, which was launched in Kabul in November 2002. It was, as one of the architects of the provincial reconstruction team plan said to me at the time, a question of doing nothing or trying to do something with the limited resources available. The establishment of the Afghan state stability in the long term was to be founded on an interrelated security sector reform process consisting of 5 pillars: justice, disarmament, demobilization and reintegration, or DDR, police, army and narcotics. But meaningful progress in all these pillars, with the exception of the development of a new Afghan army, depended on prior political reforms in the relevant ministries of the Afghan government. The international community lacked leverage, however, and political reforms, where they occurred, were partial and subjected to long delays. This was particularly apparent in the implementation of the DDR, the disarmament process, which didn't start until October 2003. The success of police reform, for which the US government plans to allocate a further $910 million, will also depend on reform taking place first or at least concurrently at the Ministry of Interior, for which there appears to be no strategy. And I must just touch on the fact that deepening concerns about security in Kabul are very much linked to a Ministry of Interior which is out of the control of the President Karzai's office and is seen as being run by criminalized gangs. Outcomes of security sector reform have been poorly analysed. Another side effect of the security situation, which has militated against the conduct of independent field research by senior academics. Academic research halted at the end of the 1970s in Afghanistan, and despite the sterling contribution of the Afghan Research and Evaluation Unit in Kabul, policymakers simply do not have enough detailed, objective information about the actual outcomes of policies being enacted. How successful is the reintegration component of DDR? Are the huge cash for work programs being implemented by USAID as an adjunct to poppy eradication efforts being manipulated by local government officials? Despite numerous calls from the NGO sector, evaluations of the cost effectiveness of other development actors, including the private sector and the military, have been virtually non-existent. Despite this, informed Afghans and expatriates alike know that ultimately the disarmament process has mainly been an expensive charade, serving to deepen existing problems of illegal armed groups and police reform. Neither will be resolved before the parliamentary elections in September. A culture of impunity, well documented by human rights organisations, both indigenous and international, continues to rule. Judicial reform has made painfully slow progress, while the crisis caused by the lack of prisons delays plans to bring well-known narcotics traders to specially convened courts. An integrated, coherent approach to security sector reform does not exist, and the lead nation format to SSR does not appear to have facilitated the formulation of one. Overall, the security gap has slowed the pace of reconstructing Afghanistan's war-shattered infrastructure and significantly increased its cost financially. The cost of insecurity was not factored into donors' development funding calculations at the first pledging conference in Tokyo in early 2002. Foreign investors needed to develop the private sector and provide jobs have been frightened off. Consequently, the private sector, designated the driver of Afghanistan's economic development by the Afghan government and its international supporters, remains and is expected to remain absent. Economic development is also hampered by the weak outcomes of civil service reform so far at the centre, which does not bode well for attempts to reform provincial administrations in which its envisaged PRTs will play a role. Most damagingly of all to the long-term success of the Bonn Agreement, the security vacuum provided optimal conditions for the restoration and rapid expansion of the opium economy. The narcotics trade has fueled corruption at all levels of government and assisted criminal networks to virtually capture ministries at the centre as well as administrative structures at the provincial and district levels. Or government administration tends to be simply ineffective due to a chronic lack of capacity. Overall, the failure to address the overarching question of security at the outset has led to the creation of a vicious rather than a virtuous circle in Afghanistan. As early as March 2003, the then Minister of Finance, Ashraf Ghani, was publicly warning donors in Kabul that the country was becoming a narco-mafia state. Opium poppy eradication efforts so far have made little impact. A recognised expert on the opium economy in Afghanistan, William Byrd of the World Bank, warns that current eradication measures have resulted in the cultivation of poppy in parts of the country where it had not been cultivated before. At a conference in May on Afghanistan post-Bonn, hosted at Wilton Park by the British government and attended by representatives from leading donor nations, members of the Afghan government and head of the UN mission in Afghanistan, the recognition that Bonn represented unfinished business resulted in the agreement of a post-Bonn compact or framework between the international community and the Afghan government. It was also agreed that the UN should continue to play some kind of coordinating role following the parliamentary elections this September. Details were not discussed, but any diminution in the political role of the UN in Afghanistan would be a backward step given the capacity constraints of the Afghan government, currently masked by expatriate technical assistance. The question was also raised as to whether, in the event of the political process failing in Afghanistan, the international community had a plan B. Critics of the international state-building efforts in Afghanistan so far would question whether there is even a plan A. Fears that the establishment of the Afghan parliament may result in the political paralysis of the executive were also aired at this conference. The issue of long-term US bases in Afghanistan is a highly controversial one and is being used in the campaigns of Karzai's political opponents in the run-up to the parliamentary elections. Ethnic polarities, clearly identifiable in the voting patterns of the October 2004 presidential elections, are reportedly hardening on the back of the Northern Alliance's subsequent loss of key ministries and the belief that the reconciliation programme aimed at the political rehabilitation of so-called moderate Taliban signalled a resurgent Pashtun political agenda at the heart of government. Political disaffection from the centre has increased in parts of the north. A UN representative who naively opened a meeting with local notables recently in Fayezabad by stating that he was there to support the central government did not get the response he expected. Should current trends continue, the stated objective of the PRTs to expand the legitimacy and authority of the central government could prove to be more of a liability than an asset. Strategists need to start thinking bottom up in their approaches. Prospects for Afghanistan's reconstruction are also affected by the regional context, as NATO analysts will be fully aware. Afghan alarm that some of its neighbours are getting up to old tricks is growing, but growing instability in Baluchistan and Uzbekistan and recent political outcomes in Iran will be further factors to be taken into account. There's no denying that the operational context to NATO's expansion is complex and challenging, or that under any circumstances, the obstacles to building a viable polity in Afghanistan to which exit strategies are linked are both historic and formidable. Much will depend on NATO having clearly defined its mission in Afghanistan and having a strategy in place to reach identified goals. Since November 2004, I've attended a series of conferences linked to NATO in which ways to enhance the synergy of civilian and military actors have been examined. These have focused on NGOs. But although NGOs continue to provide the lion's share of the acutely needed implementing capacity the government lacks, they are not involved in the political scenario that NATO has to confront. And like all development actors in Afghanistan, the long-term developmental role of NGOs has been subsumed to the short-term political objectives that have punctuated the ambitious Bonn Agreement. NATO's ability to transform itself in the post-Cold War era is now linked to its fortunes in Afghanistan. Equally, Afghanistan's chances of charting a path away from a past that holds no legitimacy for its people to a stable future will also be increasingly linked to NATO. It's highly unlikely that NATO member states will depart from the PRT format, which has accurately been labelled as an attempt to provide security on the cheap. How then can existing resources be recalibrated and refocused to further these mutual interests? At a meeting with a senior policymaker at the National Security Council in Washington in June, it was emphasised that progress towards a democratic, accountable Afghan state was an Afghan responsibility, and that to the degree that people have voice and power, they can pursue change. Afghans, demonstrating considerable bravery and sophisticated powers of judgment, are attempting to do precisely this. And if you could just bear with me for a couple more minutes, I'd like to provide a recent example to extrapolate a few lessons learned from. The essentially non-confrontational German PRT approach in Kunduz and subsequently Fayezabad in the north of Afghanistan has not received the approbation that other PRT approaches, exemplified by the British perhaps, have won. The latter tackled security issues more directly and also demonstrated a willingness to conduct far-reaching patrols on a regular basis to the outlying areas of the five northern provinces it covers from its PRT base in Mazar-i-Sharif. These patrols and regular meetings with local notables within and outside administrative structures boosted Afghan confidence that the international community was paying attention to their problems, though in effect the British PRT has punched above its weight in the promotion of raising local perceptions of international attention, that can still be enough to assist Afghans in challenging incidents of corruption and the abuse of power and altering the status quo in the process. In northern Takhar, at the end of May, there was a popular uprising against a commander led by teachers, elders and mullahs who commanded respect locally and were able to mobilise several hundred people. Approximately 150 militiamen started beating the demonstrators up, which precipitated a response from the German PRT. The Afghans had gambled on drawing in the PRT, and their gamble paid off. In addition, the local police chief, who had been recently appointed, had the confidence of the demonstrators. The German PRT is now working much more closely with UNAMA analysts in the field in terms of information sharing in the aftermath of the demonstration and is conducting weekly patrols. It has maintained contact with the leaders of the demonstration, thereby shielding them from retaliation. What lessons can be learned from this incident and this departure in the German PRT approach? That popular actions can shape the international agenda and that shifts in perception of power locally are possible to effect with active support from the PRTs, but that momentum in this and similar cases will depend on maintaining PRT engagement in support of the high expectations raised. The increased confidence that results from this type of incident that occurred in northern Takhar, news of which would have immediately spread on the Afghan grapevine, may at long last serve to put the Afghans in the driving seat, who up to now, as a colleague of mine often ruefully observes, haven't even been in the car. Lessons learned also indicate the importance of keeping the pressure on the central government to ensure the appointment of police chiefs capable of winning the confidence of Afghan people. Reportedly, there was also good coordination with the Afghan National Army. These are the kinds of synergies that are capable of delivering a transition to a more stable future in Afghanistan. It may sound like a small beginning, but if NATO member states could commit the political will to utilise existing resources and allow PRTs the flexibility to engage directly in the protection of the neutral space that, at a minimum, Afghan civil society actors need, one thing might just lead to another. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Also not an wholly optimistic story, but there's a way out, maybe. I'd like to turn... How much more time do we have? We started 50 minutes late. So I would now like to turn to the questions from the audience. If you have questions, then please introduce yourself and also state to who you'd like the question to be addressed to. Please.
You can hear me? Gail Maddox. And I wanted to direct mine to Barbara, the last commentator, but generally to the panel. It's very thought-provoking, really good, I think, discussions and discussion points. But let me just take off on a couple of points from your comments, Barbara, and that is in particular in the PRTs. I mean, when you're talking about the PRTs, you know, I'm hearing a very different thing than what I usually hear about the PRTs, which is very positive. And you have some really interesting comments. And one in particular was when you talked about better to work from the bottom up. And I'd like you to go into that a little bit more. I mean, how would you envisage? I mean, I know there has been, of course, this focus on bringing on making Kabul the real center and going out. What kind of changes exactly would be necessary in your idea of the ideal PRT? Could you be a little more specific?
Thank you for your question. I'm delighted to take that a bit further because there's a lot of discussion in Kabul amongst policymakers about decentralising. That's a whole can of worms in itself, in a sense, because I think the important thing to realise is that in Afghanistan, the emperor really does have no clothes. And if he has no clothes at the centre, it's even worse at the periphery. So if one's there to support the government, then one has to ask what one's supporting increasingly in Afghan eyes. So the new flavour of the month is a development of mechanisms called provincial development committees. And these are to be set up in all the main provincial areas of Afghanistan. They're to include the PRTs, NGOs, IOs, and local, at district level and provincial level, administrative representatives. And the sort of theory seems to be that if the local community organisations are included in the form of these so-called shuras, which you may have heard of, then we can they can ensure that there's genuine grassroots ownership of the development process and some hope that it will be directed in a way that's relevant to the grassroots. The problem with that is that, as I may have or may not have touched on in my paper, that either provincial and district level administration is ineffective or it's captured by criminal networks. And also we have the major problem of police reform. So there's endless ways to run circles around the best efforts of the PRTs and others. If I can give an example, a recent community structure that was set up in Balkh in the north of the country, which involved 125 representatives from the 125 identified communities, contained 30 commanders, former commanders, that had been through the disarmament process, of course still linked to their old networks, as indeed the police are, who've only been through brief training exercises of 2, 4, and 8 week duration, which are insufficient to break the links to the commanders. So when I say bottom up, I'm thinking that I think one has to sort of be very careful to identify the those within the fabric of Afghan society who command respect. And those are the people, as I said in my address, that you need to keep on side. So one needs to get away from perhaps looking at civil society as NGOs, which is what's happening in Afghanistan today, and look at civil society in terms of what it means within the Afghan context. And it's always been fairly robust in the Afghan context. I mean, one small example is a survey that was done in Kandahar during the height of the Taliban period by a leading NGO with over 20 years' experience in the field, showed that more girl children were at school during that period at the height of Taliban power than at any time in the past. Afghans find ways of resisting. You need to identify who those actors are, and certainly in terms of information sharing, experienced NGOs working at the grassroots, if those efforts were generally directed in those ways, I think would be willing to assist in that process. But I'm not an expert on how these things are done. I'm sure there's others who can advise. But it does need now a bottom-up approach so that and a protection of that space to allow genuine actors from the bottom to make their voice heard and to take things forward themselves.
Thank you. Anybody else from the panel would like to comment on this question? Maybe we'll go to the next question then.
Knut Kirst from the International Staff at NATO. My question is on UN-NATO relations, and as such goes to Chantal and William. I was actually intrigued by the comment of Chantal, who said that despite all our talk about the NATO-EU strategic partnership, it's actually the UN who should be our natural ally. And maybe we should focus more on institutionalizing our relationship with the UN. Now, well, NATO nations are currently discussing precisely this, and some of the elements that you recommended are under discussion at NATO. My question is, how do you see actually the interest from the UN side on NATO-UN relations, and what do they want from NATO possibly? And I think there's two different perspectives on the panel. Maybe that could be elaborated a bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe first Chantal, then.
Yeah, I think there is actually great interest from the UN side to get NATO involved. The UN has tried, the Europeans, the EU and ESDP. The Secretary General of the UN has repeatedly told and asked the Europeans to come and contribute troops to UN peacekeeping operations, because what the UN is in dire need of is highly trained military, and it hasn't got those. So, you know, I think after having tried the EU, hasn't worked. The ESDP is not, you know, the sort of the standby force that some at some point thought it would be for the UN. And so I think that's why the UN Secretary General is very interested in engaging NATO, particularly to get this type of highly trained, capable military, as well as procedures on the command control type of issues, information sharing, and things like that.
Yeah, I would concur with Chantal that the UN is very interested in having more NATO support than they certainly get now. Most NATO countries contribute forces to NATO operations. It's really relatively small percentage contribute to, other than the traditional sort of Middle Eastern Mediterranean basin operations. Australia and Portugal had a special interest in East Timor, but other than that, we've seen most of the contributions diverted to NATO-flagged NATO-flagged missions. The Secretary General of the UN asked for an interlocking system of peace support, and that means working out a good, not a subservient, but a mutually supporting division of labor based on capabilities and resources. And, of course, most of the UN's resources financially for all of its operations come from Europe, from Japan, from the United States. So something like 96% of peacekeeping funds come from the developed group. So there is a contribution already in terms of money, but in terms of engineering units, intelligence capacity, field communications, special forces, understated but very valuable. Swedish special forces were part of Artemis in Bunia and were very highly regarded. I really hoped that they would have stayed after the main force left. They didn't. On the other hand, Sweden and Ireland, I think, are the only two European countries to contribute infantry troops to a UN operation. That is in Liberia, where I believe they formed the mechanized reserve force for UNMIL. So both to be commended.
Could I just add one thing? If you read Romeo Dallaire's book on Rwanda, or the way in which the peacekeeping operation was put together in Sierra Leone, you see such fragmented and frightening decision-making that, as well as the interest in having NATO capability, and there's built real political problems about that, deploying any NATO resources into Africa and so on, as we all know, the tightening up of the ability of the UN to plan and organise peace enforcement operations and so on is desperately needed, and I'm sure a contribution could be made there. I mean, clearly there's growing sensitivity about NATO in a divided world, but I think people could be seconded, there could be a real effort that would improve and enhance the effectiveness of some of the existing peacekeeping operations.
There's one more question there, please.
Yeah, I'm Maria Hugo, Deputy Chairperson of OIS Germany from Berlin. I have a question basically directed to Barbara Stapleton, but also if someone else wants to answer to that. That is going back to Afghanistan. Everybody agrees that one of the major problems is narcotics, drug trafficking in Afghanistan. And in particular, the German forces that are out there are not allowed to participate in any missions on counter-narcotics. In particular, the German parliament has said that's not one of their tasks, because that's policing and not a military mission military task. Where do you see the solution? Do you think it really requires forces, or what other ways could that problem be handled?
I was rather dreading questions on the narcotic situation because it's not an area that I'm an expert in, but I would thoroughly recommend going to the World Bank site and downloading anything by William Byrd. Not only has he been based in and bordering Afghanistan and Pakistan for many years, what he has to say commands respect and agreement with Afghans as well as international analysts on the situation. The problem with narcotics is such an immense one, and it's one that's tied into, of course, the failure to address the security vacuum and basically providing optimal conditions, as I mentioned. And now the toothpaste is out of the tube. What you do, especially with the fact that it represents such a significant percentage of the Afghan economy, and the fact that the people involved in the cultivation, and I don't mean even the landowners, I mean the migrant labour in terms of within Afghanistan that's brought in for the harvest and what have you, the drought conditions, everything makes it the perfect crop. And of course the differentials between a metric ton of wheat produced and opium poppy. So for the Afghans, poppy means development. In small towns in Badakhshan, where there's nothing, there's now a few shops, and people can buy cheap Chinese toys for their children for the first time and have a little bit of disposable income. It's not an easy thing to ask people to step away from this. The other major problem is that at district, provincial, and at central levels of the government, those known to be deeply involved in the narcotics trade are within government. So why should they take seriously messages about opium poppy production being counter to Islamic norms, etc., etc.? There will be no silver bullet for this, and a tremendous amount of money is being put into an attempt to fast forward alternative livelihoods. But what do phrases like alternative livelihoods actually refer to? They refer to the rural economy, which is linked into the wider economy in Afghanistan, which, for reasons I touched on, because of the security, lack of sufficient administrative reform and other factors, the creation of jobs is not happening as was perhaps anticipated. So everything is interrelated. We have, from the NGO side, very much supported interdiction, which targets the drug traffickers, but we're very concerned about associated effects of eradication, particularly in the short term. And the Afghan NGOs amongst us, I've never seen them be so disturbed at the situation, because it has a huge knock-on effect. As many of you may or may not be aware, the access to the Afghan population outside of the north, particularly in the south and southeast, is through our Afghan colleagues. And for them, eradication policies hugely added to their personal security problems. So it's a very, very complex question, and I would direct you towards the experts for any solution, well thought through solutions, rather than my sketching them.
Well, thank you very much. I'm just told that our time is up. It's very hard to conclude this discussion, as we did go from one more optimistic voice that calls on NATO to make post-conflict reconstruction the core task, to another panel member which is concerned about the frightening incompetence involved in certain agencies who aren't involved in it. It does show that it will continue to be debated, and it's very hard to conclude out of this discussion. But thank you very much.